That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game with me, Kevin Day, and him, Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. Luckily, Kieran came through Storm Franklin unscathed, although Kieran, I believe, Storm Baroness, is still raging after having to drink warm champagne for 5 days.
Yes, she's not very happy. Storm Franklin did give me a nice bus journey from Brighton to Liverpool for a significant part of the journey on Monday. But yeah, we're all in one piece and raring to go, of course.
Yes, I did a big benefit gig in London on Monday night, which is part of a charity that Jonathan Pearce, the plus-sized TV football commentator, is part of. And he couldn't travel from Brighton to London. And if anyone you'd think would be unaffected by a large wind, it'd be a 22 stone man. But there you go. Phil Tufnell was in the audience, which was lovely. And later in the show, we'll be hearing from former Aston Villa, Everton and Aberdeen chief executive Keith Wyness. But before that, Kieran, it's Newsday, and we have plenty of it. And I think the first story is good news. Bury fan group Est 1885 have completed the purchase of Gig Lane.
Yes, this is a relief, first of all, that the stadium has effectively been preserved. What's happened is that there has been a government grant from the Community Ownership Fund of £1 million. That's been matched by some investors, or there's been significant amounts raised from relatively few investors who have put in large amounts, but they're trying to generate more money all the time. So what we now have at Bury is that we've got a football ground without a football club in Est 1885, to a certain extent, because they've not got players or managers. And then we've got a football club in AFC without a ground to call their own.
Right.
Now, there's a case here for these two parties coming together and forming a solution, which I'm hoping is going to be the case. So there have been a few run-ins between certain factions within the alternative fan bases. You know, it's a bit like the People's Republic of Judea versus the Judean People's Front.
Yeah.
But I did hear an interview a couple of days ago from somebody from Est 1885. It looks like, you know, the two parties are now talking to each other. And I think what's most important is that if they can both use their independent skill sets and bring them together, that can only be for the benefit. And that's got to increase the chances of being able to have a Bury football club in as high a tier as possible with the, you know, with the rubber stamping of the FA.
And will the government be expecting anything in return for that £1 million? Because God knows this is a government that expects something in return normally.
Yes, it will be very much a community project. It will be a case of evidencing that they're going to have a women's team, that there's going to be youth development. I think initially they're going to be playing in grass, but there is talk about having a 3G pitch or a 4G pitch, whatever they're called these days, That could then be used and hired out for the community. So it will be monitoring. I believe the council are being asked to put in a six-figure sum as well. And at present, they will do so with conditions, i.e., you know, it's the money's got to be used appropriately, again, to build together community-based projects using the facilities of Gig Lane as a hub. So there are conditions attached, but they are the right conditions, in my view.
Right. And just to clarify, these are loans or grants?
These are grants.
Right.
So you know, the money is there. I did see a tweet from the government's Levelling Up Fund sort of saying something along those lines.
That's very good. I'm glad that Michael Gove has clarified that for us all. The governing body for sport in Wales has launched an emergency grant fund for Welsh sports clubs whose facilities were damaged by Storm Eunice. And I know you were inconvenienced by it, Kieran, but in Wales it caused considerable damage, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Wales and quite a lot of the south coast. I mean, I'm up here in Liverpool, but we've had another power cut following Storm Franklin. So it's happening lots of communities. But fair play to the Welsh Government. What they've done here is that Sports Wales have said, and this is aimed at grassroots football, which, you know, as we know, has suffered hugely on the back of the pandemic, and just as we're really sort of starting to make some progress in terms of establishing football, these storms have been pretty bad news. So your grants of between £300 and £5,000 will be available to fix damage, and you've got to claim before February the 28th. So if you are a Welsh club, you've not got a lot of leeway, but you know, we would encourage you to make the applications and again be able to offer sporting facilities and just the sheer joy of being able to go and watch a football match and go in the clubhouse afterwards, which does mean so much to so many people.
It does make you wonder, Kieran, and yes, I understand that there's no reason that football should be treated differently to any other business, but this money is clearly available when bad things happen. So why can't it be available when clubs are struggling just in general? Why does it have to wait for a disaster before the government cough up and say, here you are, we can help, when under normal circumstances they're most reluctant to help, aren't they?
Well, I believe there is no such thing as a magic money tree. If you were applying for PPE grants, and if we take a look at the latest parliamentary report in terms of the extent of the fraud which has taken place, and which is absolutely appalling, £15 billion, that's going to hit taxpayers for a long period of time. But that's for another podcast, I think.
Yes, indeed it is, because producer guy tells us off if we get political. We all know why. We can imagine which way his politics lie, because he's a multi-billionaire. You sounded just like Ali then when you said there's no such thing as a magic money tree.
It's good to give you your pocket money.
I hear that expression quite a lot. as well as this, you'd be amazed how many things don't grow on trees as well. It's incredible. Whenever she says that, I go, who am I, Chris Packham? The EFL are to clamp down on clubs who are late paying wages. This is probably long overdue as well, isn't it?
Yes, if we take a look at what has happened historically, there's sort of been a case by case review, and charges have been made. If we go back to what happened in respect of Macclesfield Town, where the owner there was absolutely appalling with regards to the payment of wages, it could also have been argued that had there been automatic penalties arising when Steve Dale first acquired Bury Football Club, because there were issues with wages there, that perhaps he could have been dealt with quicker than he was, and perhaps Bury Football Club could have been saved. The one caveat I have here is that under the proposed new rules, clubs have to self-report. Now, if you are a wrong'un, the last thing you're going to do is to self-report the non-payment of wages. I mean, admittedly, it might come out fairly quickly, because the players would find out, the players would go to the PFA, and the PFA would take it up. But if you do delay the payment of wages, you would be subject to an immediate transfer embargo. So again, in January, in the summer months, our club's going to self-report if they're trying to get a couple of players in. There is the scope for a bit of shenanigans, shall we say? But I think it does act as a deterrent from those owners who have perhaps gambled on clubs and then trying to weasel their way out of their financial commitments, because it looks as if the points deductions will be automatic. Rather than going through a panel, as has happened historically.
Yeah, you can't imagine players not actually mentioning the fact they're not being paid any wages. And also, it seems odd that you would try and avoid a transfer embargo to bring in new players that you can't pay anyway. Since, you know, we're not paying the 24 we got, let's bring in two more and not pay them. this next expression is one I didn't expect to ever use in my life, Kieran. There's a story coming up about Man City that has a concept I never expected to discuss in my life. But this this next expression, VAR light, VAR light, is to be rolled out across the EFL and Women's Super League. Obviously, I'm legally obliged as a comedian to say if they do it quickly, it will be the VAR light express. But what on earth is, I mean, VAR's, I mean, just VAR itself is bad enough, but what's VAR like? And how much is it going to cost the EFL Women's Super League?
Well, VAR Lite is a pared down version of what we presently have in the Premier League, where there are, I think it's around about 20 cameras. What the EFL and the WSL are considering at present is I think you can have 3-4 cameras involved, and it is there to assist the referee. It looks as if the offside lines, which have brought so much joy to the nation over the course of the last couple of years, as we try to work out whether somebody's elbow is offside or other such strange interpretations of the law. The rules are simple. If it's one of our players, he's not offside. If he's one of theirs, he's offside. Now, that's what I call VAR light, and it's a lot quicker and simpler, isn't it?
Kieran, we've discussed this before. Why they just don't put it to a vote? Exactly. All you have to do is have a button under every seat at Selhurst Park on the Amex, and you just get the fans to press whether or not they think it's offside. It's much simple, much more effective. It seems a strange halfway house to me. I mean, I watched the Arsenal women versus Chelsea women a week or two ago, and there was a blatant handball in the last seconds. And you know, VAR, you'd like to think, would pick that up, although it didn't pick up West Ham. Dawson elbowing the ball into the back of the net against Leicester. It seems strange to me. You either have it properly or you don't have it. But in terms of finances, who's going to pay for this, Kieran?
It would have to be paid by the central authorities themselves, and effectively it would impact upon the distribution of money to individual clubs. The aim is to try to reduce the number of errors which are made by referees. And although, you know, we do, you know, jibe at referees, they do get 98% of decisions right. You know, if you take a look at historically, VAR has increased the number of correct decisions in terms of where the law presently stands. Now, you can argue, this is clearly a discussion best made in the pub as to which laws should be changed in respect of the game to take into account the acceleration of technology. But with the price of football in terms of qualifying for Champions League, getting relegated, getting promoted, the numbers involved are so huge. That's why the technology was introduced, because there's this huge pressure on referees, and they do deserve perhaps a bit more sympathy, because we've both been watching football for a good 50 years. It's a lot faster than it used to be. And the players cheat a lot more than they used to as well. So you put those two factors together, and the referees do need assistance. And that's why, you know, I've said, and I think some others have said, take out some of the responsibilities for the referee, such as timekeeping, for example, and make that an independent role for somebody else. And that can help in terms of time wasting and so on.
Yeah, you say we've been watching it for a good 50 years. I'd say 5 years of it have been good. We have been watching it for 50 years.
True.
Well, it will also, if there is VAR EFL grounds now as well, it will also take out that ludicrous anomaly where some FA Cup ties are down by VAR and some aren't, which I don't think is entirely fair. Now, this is a phrase I don't often get to use, Kieran, either. But it's not been a good week for Russian oligarchs. it sounds like it. That should be a satirical comedy, shouldn't it? It's not been a good week for Russian oligarchs as they've got some big sanctions coming their way. But we've just discovered, Kieran, how much Russian oligarch Roman Abramovich has lent to Chelsea over the years, and it's rather a tidy amount of money, isn't it?
Yes, it is £1.514 billion.
Wow.
So that's a lot of zeros.
Yeah.
And you know, we've said before, Chelsea have made the highest losses of all the clubs in the Premier League over the course of its existence. Nearly all of those losses, or a significant proportion of those losses, have arisen since Roman Abramovich acquired the club. And you know, we there's this phrase that I use sometimes called, which is trophy asset. It's where somebody buys into a business or buys into a project with no intention of getting a financial return. And clearly that is the case with Roman Abramovich. And he controls Chelsea FC PLC via his private company, which is called Fordstam Limited, which in turn is owned by a company called Camberley International Investments, which again, having done some searching, it's based in either or perhaps both of Jersey and the British Virgin Islands. So we're hoping to take the Price of Football Live to Jersey. We have had an invite, so perhaps we can pop along to the offices there of Camberley International. And if producer guy wants to send us to the British Virgin Islands on a second fact finding trip, I'm sure me and you could, yeah, we could have a TV show out of this.
Yeah, that's quite true. You remember that phrase you used earlier, self reporting?
Yes.
Our trip to the British Virgin Islands would be self paying. Yeah. Guy's policy would be very much, yes, of course you can go to the British Virgin Islands. I'll send you a link to British Airways website. I think we'll probably speak about this more on Sunday, Kieran, when we get more details. But UEFA announced yesterday that they would be looking at sanctions for some of the Russian owners of football clubs across Europe. So we'll get Guy to do some research on that, because that could have some disturbing, not necessarily for Chelsea, but it could certainly have some disturbing implications for big clubs across Europe financially. So we'll go into that in some detail on Sunday. In the meantime, Monday, I beg your pardon. It's confusing because we're recording on Sunday, and also because we're recording this at stupid o'clock in the morning. So,
well, morning is
fine. Well, yes, I'm aware actually that 20 past nine for some people is halfway through the working day, but for me, it really isn't. Now, it says here that some club called Brighton are going to pay their non-playing staff bonuses of 20% if they finish in the top half of the table, which seems nice on the outside. I haven't delved into it, but it seems like a nice gesture from a billionaire.
Well, it's, you know, as somebody that's worked in the world of employment as well, you're fully aware of incentivizing staff. So,
yeah,
so what Brighton have done is that when they first got to the Premier League, I believe staff were given a 10% bonus if the club avoided relegation, and that then stopped for a couple of years. This is from David Ornstein in the Athletic, who's reported this. But they now have a bonus scheme which says if they finished in the top half of the table, and let's be honest, that's not been something as a fan I've really had to worry about for the first four seasons of the Premier League. If we finish in the top half, that bonus increases to 20%, and then it goes up by an additional 2% for every additional place. So if we do go on a remarkable run and both Manchester City and Liverpool do a Fwanavon, that's that. Google that one, kids. then we could that Brighton could be paying a bonus of 40% of wages to non-playing staff. But I think, you know, rivalries aside, I think this is a good way to make staff realise that they are part of the overall welfare and benefits of the football club. If staff do their rights, do their jobs correctly, it helps get the players in the right frame of mind, and the players do their jobs rightly, it helps to get the staff. So if you everybody effectively, you know, supporting each other, and ultimately, you know, you are all colleagues, then that is to be applauded. You know, the players will have their own bonus schemes, which will be linked. And the reason why the club can do this or can afford to do this, if people say, well, you know, is it going to be expensive? Remember, in the Premier League, we now have what's referred to as merit payments. And with the most recent recalibration of the numbers, it's worth around about £2.2 million per place. If you finish, you know, 10th compared to 11th and so on. So the money is coming out of the success pot that the club itself would receive.
Yes, it's a success pot. Is that a word? That doesn't sound right somehow, does it? Sounds vaguely sinister. It's a good thing that Brighton is doing. The problem is, of course, Kieran, that the playing staff are going to be less than popular with the non-playing staff if they finish 11th. There's going to be a lot of tea accidentally spilt in players' laps around about May 5th. This next story, Kieran, is a particularly sad one, and it's taken a long time to reach this stage. I was going to say conclusion, but it's not a conclusion at all for the family involved. But Ajax have finally agreed a settlement with the family of Api Nouri, and it's taken close on 5 years for this to happen, Kieran. Perhaps you could give us a little bit of context about the story before you talk about the finances.
Yep. Api Nouri was a player who came through the academy ranks at Ajax. He played for the Netherlands national youth team at under 15, 16, 17 level. He was a promising midfield player. And then, tragically, there was a pre-season friendly against Werder Bremen, and he suffered a cardiac arrhythmia on the pitch, I believe.
Yeah.
And There was inadequate medical treatment at the time, and they failed to resuscitate the young man. I think he was only 17 or 18 at the time. Ajax themselves undertook an investigation, and the conclusions of the investigation was that more should have been done at the time. The young man went into a coma. He suffered severe brain damage as a result of this. So what Ajax have done, they've agreed to pay all of his historic, they have been paying his medical bills. They will continue to pay his future medical bills. They've agreed a further settlement with the family of around about £6.4 million to assist for his care going forward. So I think the club, they've acknowledged that things were not right. They have investigated. There hasn't been an attempt to sweep this under the carpet. Do these things take time? Well, medical investigations are never quick. But it's still a tragedy, you know. And you know, we saw at the weekend what happened in the Leeds versus Manchester United match.
Yeah.
And Chris Sutton and others have been, I think, very quick and rightly so to say that. Footballers are young men and young women, and they can suffer severe damage, and more should be done, because you know your head's very important, you know, in terms of, you know, we've got a skull, it is a protective organ, but you know, you can suffer significant damage, and you know, in terms of what's happened with early onset dementia, any head injury should be taken more seriously in terms of concussion, and the authorities are not moving fast enough. So in terms of Ajax, I think they've done the right thing. They've acknowledged they've made errors, and they've also retired his number 34 shirt. And I think if If you think about some of the Dutch players that play in the Premier League and elsewhere, you know, fans might wonder why such and such a player wearing the number 34 shirt. So we've got the likes of Justin Kluivert, Joel Veltman at my club Brighton, Donny van de Beek, Anwar El Ghazi. They wear the number 34 shirt because they've all got connections with Ajax in honour of Appie Nouri. And you know, even if it just makes a few people think twice about if you're at park football, if somebody gets a concussion injury, somebody gets a head injury, don't say to him, you know, I'm going to show you three fingers, count those three fingers, you're all right, play on. Take it more seriously.
Yeah, Chris Sutton, for those of you listening outside the UK, Chris Sutton is an ex-footballer. I had a relationship with him a long time ago because he had a cameo role in a play that I was involved in. It's not a pundit I often agree with, I have to say, on 606. And when you throw Robbie Savage into that mix, it's two reasons why I don't often listen to 606. But I heard him on Sunday talking about the Leeds thing because Chris Sutton is convinced that his dad, who was also a footballer, died because of brain injury incurred by a repetitive heading of the ball. His cold, articulate fury about the Leeds substitute, yeah, the Leeds player being allowed to play on for 30 odd minutes with a head injury was very impressive. He was absolutely furious. You could tell how emotional he was, but he was absolutely right. And when you see things like the Appie Nouri story happening 5 years ago, it's taken too long to come to grips with this. And it's, you know, when we have this, we've got concussion substitutes now, so there's no excuse for taking a risk. It's ludicrous to take any sort of risk with anybody's life, especially when you could quite clearly see it was a bit, you know, just watching the game, you could see from the blood and you could see from his posture that he was in a certain amount of pain, and you could see when he came on to the pitch that he wasn't quite right. So it is something that needs to be properly dealt with. If that's not a good news story, this next one is a good news story, and it's come as somewhat as a surprise and probably come quicker than we thought it would happen. But the US Soccer Federation, Kieran, and the US Women's National Team have agreed to settle a class action equal pay lawsuit.
Yes, the US Women's National Team have for a long period of time said that we are, you know, we're incredibly successful. We've won Olympics competitions. We've won the World Cup on a regular basis. Why are we the poor relations in terms of football? Because women's football in the States is at a huge, got a huge profile.
Yeah.
So they have now just agreed a $22 million settlement. It's only about a third of what the women's national team were asking for, but that's the way of legal settlements. You know, you pitch high, you accept low. We've seen that in respect of other settlements in other claims and so on. Some of that money is going to be allocated specifically for post-retirement training for people from the US Women's National Team, which again I think is good. It's progressive. You know, and it stops people scrimmage. The money's just going into players' pockets. It's going to be frittered away. So it's an acknowledgement, I think, of the huge contribution to women's football that the USA has made. In terms of increasing the profile, both domestically and internationally, and its acknowledgement of that it delivers in terms of viewing figures as well. So that there's little justification in having a discriminatory pay structure.
Yeah, it means, of course, that going forward, horrible phrase, let's go for in the future. So men and women who represent the USA will be paid the same amount of money, which is good. And it's also a moral victory, Kieran, because it's only 2 years ago since the head of the US Soccer Federation was claiming quite openly in court that the men's game was faster and more entertaining and more important, and therefore they should be paid more money. So this is a victory for women's football all over the world, really, isn't it?
Yes. And I know that there are some other countries where they now have equal pay in respect of the national teams, and it's difficult to, I think, to justify otherwise. You know, at the domestic level, there is a case for saying, and it is a valid case, that ultimately wages are determined by revenue, and if the men's you know, the men's sort of club teams are bringing in more revenue, then you can see why it's market forces, rightly or wrongly, that leads to the wages which are being paid. But if you are representing your country, then I can't see the same thing applies. You know, you are still a proud citizen of either the USA or England or Norway or Nigeria or China or whatever the country is going to be. It doesn't matter. You are representing your country. You've got the same pride in wearing the shirt and doing so, and therefore surely remuneration should be equal.
Yeah, we have one more story, Kieran, before our interview with Keith Wyness. I don't understand it, Kieran. I mean, we're men of a certain age, but it says here on this email I've got from producer Guy, it says that Manchester City have started building the world's first football stadium inside the metaverse. It's it's a long way from Subutio, isn't it? I mean, we thought the future had come when you could buy a Subutio stand and put that next to your bed. Not that I did, but you know, it was available. You could click it together and put it next to your sofa. While the Generation Game was on, you could recreate today's Palace defeat. But yeah, I'm coming to grips with the metaverse. But why does it need a football stadium? It's going to need more than one for a start, isn't it? I don't know.
Well, the argument is that Manchester City, and of course many other clubs, especially in the Premier League and elsewhere around the world, they have fan bases which are diverse in many ways, including geographical representation. And you can only get 54,000 people.
Sorry, Kieran, can I just stop you there? When you say diverse in geographical representation, do you mean don't live in Manchester?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Just so I know.
if you can't get the fans from, you know, in the case of Manchester City, yeah, clearly they've got a big Middle East fan base. They're building up their fan bases elsewhere in the world on the back of the incredible success that they've had. If you can't get the fans to Manchester, can you get the stadium to where they are? And this is what Manchester City are doing with, and I quote, their new official virtual fan engagement partner in the shape of Sony. So what Sony are going to do is they're going to use Sony own Hawkeye, which we know from tennis, and is also involved. I think it's involved in VAR as well. So they're going to build a virtual stadium which will allow you to attend the matches, and you can watch the match from, you know, four or 500 different angles during the game. You can then choose your own avatar to represent you in the virtual stadium. And you can be high-fiving and impressing people with your knowledge of football on this virtual stadium by having virtual conversations with them. And then presumably, if it's like Brighton's match against Burnley on Saturday, you can virtually leave 15 minutes before the end of the match and say that you're never going to go again to go and watch that shower of shite. So they're trying to make it realistic. And the aim is, of course, ultimately you're going to be charging money for this.
Yeah,
so it's trying to work out, and football has been struggling to come to terms with this for a long period of time. We've got ticket sales, we've got traditional broadcast revenues, we've got commercial income. How else can we extract money from people? And as you say, yeah, people not in Manchester or people not in London to watch Palace or not in Brighton to watch Brighton. You know, what can we do? So that's what they're trying to do, and you would imagine that some of the big clubs, the likes of Real, Liverpool, and Bayern, and so on, they see huge opportunities in this. Is the technology there yet? We're probably some way to go, but you know, you and I, we both remember Tron, don't we? From when we were quite young, and that's what they've been trying to do for donkey's years, and I think they're getting closer and closer. So it's the equivalent of Tron. Again, this is BAFTA BAFTA generating commentary here from me in terms of being so up to date with what's happening in the world, is trying to bring the equivalent of Tron into football and getting people to pay for it.
I believe Tron is what somebody called Ronnie's refer to in Yorkshire. Man City fans have got other things to worry about at the moment. A very good friend of mine, Ina, who's a lovely posh lady from Cheshire, who's Man City season ticket holder, follows them home and away and across Europe, just apoplectic, along with many Man City fans, that their game at Selhurst Park against us is now at 8 o'clock on a Monday. She just can't get there. It's just ludicrous. It's just ludicrous to ask Man City fans to try and get to Selhurst Park for 8 o'clock on a Monday. But also, very quickly, Kieran, while we're in Manchester, Man United have been fined, I think, £20,000 for failing to control their players after their outburst against your club last week.
Yes, it was superb refereeing from Harry Maguire to refer a foul to the
refereeing.
it was the fastest he ran all match. We didn't take our chances. Manchester United took theirs. That's football. And no issue with them taking the lead. But what's come to Manchester United when they need to have eight players surrounding a referee trying to get a player from Brighton sent off? Yeah, that's a pretty low bar that they're setting. We're nothing to worry about.
Yeah, that's true. Although I wouldn't approve of their behaviour against any other team, Kieran, but obviously in that circumstance, I know exactly how they feel now. It's interview time, Kieran. And if I asked our listeners who manages each Premier League club, they would probably be able to tell you. If I asked them who owns each Premier League club, they'll probably be able to tell you. But I doubt if they'll know who the CEOs are at those clubs. And we spoke to Keith Wyness, who had that role at Aberdeen, Everton and Aston Villa. And I think fans of all three clubs are going to be very interested in this. And I think fans of Villa in particular are going to be very, very interested in what Keith had to say. This episode of The Price of Football is brought to you by the AI-powered workspace Notion. We are living in an era of information overload and we have more knowledge than ever before. But what do we do with it all? If you're in Notion, you put that knowledge to work.
It's a workspace designed not just for making progress, but getting inspired. And all I can say on a personal level, as for somebody whose life is quite chaotic and I'm writing pieces for government and newspapers and media content, I've got my university commitments and I'm supposed to be writing a book, I use Notion all the time because it brings order into chaos.
Well, if you need order brought to your chaos, you can try Notion for free when you go to notion.com/priceoffootball. That's all lowercase letters, notion.com/priceoffootball, and start turning your ideas into action. That's notion.com/priceoffootball.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Keith, thank you very much for joining us. This sounds like an odd question to start, but what is the CEO role? At my club, Crystal Palace, we've got the owners, we've got the chairman, and we've got Phil Alexander, who's a very good CEO. But are they all involved in the decision-making progress, or is it the CEO's job to expedite the decisions made by the owners?
It really varies again in every club. I mean, each owner has their own particular level of involvement that they want to get into, their own personalities, their own, you know, other business commitments that may impinge on their time. So in the three clubs that I've been involved in, it's been probably a slightly different role But one thing's for sure, you can be guaranteed that you're going to be left all the problems to try and sort.
Yeah, fair enough. It does seem that way at Palace sometimes. It's like Steve Parish has an idea and it lands on Phil's desk and he has to sort it out. Tell us a little bit about your life before football, Keith, and then if you don't mind, we'll go through your clubs in chronological order.
Yeah, the brief potted history was after college, I joined the British Airways graduate scheme and had 6 years at the airline where I was involved in the marketing team for the Concorde. I set up the British Airways Executive Club and was really enjoying the airline, having a great time. But we saw the cruise industry was just starting to blossom in the mid-80s. And I left the airline with a friend and we went off to America. We raised a load of money, about $125 million, and then built the world's first twin-hull cruise ship with Radisson Hotels. And I ended up having 12 years in Miami, which was fantastic. It was the Miami Vice era and was a pretty exciting place to live at the time. I was then asked to go down after my British Airways Executive Club sort of experience. I was asked to go down and do a similar thing for the Sydney Olympics. And so I had 5 years in Sydney pre the Olympics organising, which I always said is the hardest job I've ever had, was to get Australians excited about sport. So we did that and we did all the events leading up to the games to get them excited and get the whole thing moving.
Yeah.
And that was fantastic. And I was going to stay down in Australia. I was offered a chance to go in as CEO at the Australian Cricket Board, but my father passed away back in Aberdeen, which is my hometown.
Yeah.
And I went back to look after my mother and wasn't sure what I was going to do because I wasn't very good at oil and gas and the oil rigs. Didn't have much knowledge about fishing or farming. So somebody said, well, why don't you run the football club? And that's how I got involved in football, literally a bit of serendipity. And so I ended up at Aberdeen.
A little bird, you, as it happens, told me that you tried your hand at stand-up comedy as well.
Well, that goes way back to when I first joined British Airways. I was pretty aware that I'd have to do quite a bit of public speaking with the new job. And so I thought there's no better way to try and get over the fear of public speaking than by, if you can conquer stand-up, then, you know, everything else is easy. So I did give it a go and, as I say, got booed off twice and then a lukewarm round of applause on the third time. And I thought, that's it, I'll go out at the top.
Yeah, I think it's my third ever stand-up gig. I got booed on and I got booed off. So that was good going. You, when you went to Aberdeen, you introduced quite radical changes, especially to player contracts. Tell us a little bit about that. And did you start introducing those changes because you knew nothing about the world of football?
It was certainly, I was one of the sort of the few people that were starting to come into football who had come from outside of football. And so it gave us a bit of a fresh start. But reality is, I wish I could say that it was all innovation and I was this brilliant business brain, but I came into Aberdeen the same year that Sky withdrew their contract from the SPL. And so there was a huge drop in revenue. And we had to then do something about completely reorganizing the finances. And so we did bring in a lot more incentive-based payments that the players accepted. And so that was really what it was, you know, necessity is the mother of invention, so to speak. So that's really where it started from.
And I mean, it's a model that other club owners and CEOs have taken. Was it Daniel Levy in particular? It's the sort of model he's based Spurs on, isn't it?
Yeah, I think we were certainly the first to try it. And you're right that sort of coming from outside of football allowed me to look at it with some fresh eyes. But it certainly, you know, was the way that we managed to get the club back on a financially even footing, and so it was pretty important. But then we had the big battle with the old firm, which is still going on probably today. That was always a huge part of my my issues at Aberdeen.
Do you mean in terms of football or in terms of the distribution of wealth in Scotland?
Well, it was, you may, I don't know if people look at it now, but still, we actually resigned, 10 clubs actually resigned from the SPL and left Rangers and Celtic alone in the league.
Yeah.
So they would have been like the Harlem Globetrotters and they'd have had to play themselves continually. And it was a pretty bold move to have, you know, obviously have 10 clubs resign. And living in Scotland at the time, it was leading every news headline story. I mean, it was a huge thing. But we did actually win the negotiation and got a fairer share of the spoils going forward. And I've got to say it was a successful negotiating tactic at the time, although it really was, as I say, a major story and led to all sorts of different, should we say, issues behind the scenes.
Yeah, I can imagine. You cross the old firm at your peril. Kieran and I grew up at a time when Scotland was a major force in world football and Scottish clubs were a major force in European football. Do you ever see a time where that can happen again or someone other than Celtic and Rangers can win the title?
Yeah, I'm cautiously optimistic that we're seeing a little bit of an improvement in the Scottish game. There's certainly a number of players coming through that seem to be making it the Premier League. You can always judge it by the number of players in the Scottish team that are in the Premier League. And, yeah, the recent national performances have been quite good. It does appear that clubs like Dundee United and some other clubs have managed to get some good academy work going. Aberdeen, I know, has got a few good academy things going. So I do feel reasonably optimistic about it going forward.
And you left Aberdeen and went to Everton. Were you headhunted?
Yeah, that was the issue. I was actually asked to come down. At the same time, I was Doug Ellis had asked me to come and run Villa, but I chose to go with Bill. And we moved down. I think my son was born the same week I moved to Everton. And I was introduced at an extraordinary general meeting rather than an annual general meeting when the club was in meltdown. First thing we had to do was sell Wayne Rooney, and the whole club was in a complete mess. I walked into it, and we were on the intensive care list with the bank. There was all sorts of issues with the staff. They were in seven different locations. There was no cohesion, and the place was in a mess. And it was an interesting challenge to come into Merseyside at that time.
You were an early advocate as well of a move away from Goodison Park. Did that make you popular at the club, and why did that not happen?
Well, that was a really good story, that one. We didn't have a wealthy owner at that time, and part of the way to try and advance the club was to try and get a new stadium, and we had a particularly good deal with Tesco's at the time, who were going to be building what was going to be the biggest Tesco's in Britain over at Knowsley, and that was going to be an area that would have then given us what they call planning gain and assisted in building the stadium. Now, we actually did ballot all the season ticket holders, and the majority were in favour of going. But I understand there was a group that didn't want to leave Goodison. Of course, I understand that. We love Goodison, but it really is a difficult stadium to actually manage and to get revenue. Yeah. And we then hit the financial crisis in 2008, which everybody suffered from. And, of course, Tesco's decided, well, it's not the right time to build our biggest Tesco's in one of the most depressed areas in Britain. So the whole planning, it got called in and it didn't go ahead. Obviously, it's great to see now the new stadium Everton's going to get. But at that time, it was what we felt was the right opportunity. But with hindsight, now with a new owner, etc., it's probably good it didn't go ahead.
Is it fair to say, Keith, that at the time you thought that Liverpool City Council looked more favourably on one club in the city than the other?
There was always, I mean, that whole city, the city's red and blue. I mean, it is, and there's always shades of politics getting involved. I did think that we were not supported properly by the local council at the time. And we had issues also with all sorts of people. I mean, like the chief constable at the time was Bernard Hogan Howe. And he was a nightmare to deal with. And, it's just part of the sort of the landscape for a chief executive to take whatever you're dealt with in terms of your local authorities, and you just have to handle the issues and get through it.
And why have you got a relationship with the chief constable in the first place? Surely he's beyond the sort of normal day-to-day match-day policing of games, isn't he?
Well, you'd have thought so, but he saw the club. I mean, he was a classic sort of... His main hobbies were equestrian, and all he would see was headlines about football was that, we were signing players for supposedly huge amounts of money. Right. And so when his budget was being squeezed, he thought, here's a source of cash for us. We'll go and put up our police prices by 45%.
Oh, wow.
On a whim. And, of course, once you've done your budget, you can't sort of have that sort of cost. So I had to educate him into the reality of it. And he threatened us with taking away the safety certificate and things like that. And I said, okay, well, if you're going to do that, then you be the person that can explain to the fans on Merseyside that you're stopping their football.
Yeah,
and I think you might see a different side to it.
Yeah, you talk about budgets there. Bill Kenwright, I have to say, is always incredibly generous to me when I went to Goodison Park in a broadcasting capacity, and I like him. But was your problem the fact that Bill was a very, very loyal and staunch Everton fan and a very committed owner, but his pockets weren't anywhere near as deep as some of the other clubs in the Premier League, and they were, you know, they were getting deeper and deeper by the month, weren't they, those pockets?
Yeah, I mean, there was that time when we were probably the same. There was probably four or five clubs like Newcastle, Villa, Everton, Spurs, were all West Ham, all about the same sort of abilities. And it hadn't really exploded into the, you know, the big mega money at the time just then. It was just about to happen. And look, I loved Bill to death, and we had a great relationship together and still do. But yes, I mean, he knew himself he wasn't the deepest of pockets. And that's what led to some issues and led me to resign in the end.
You mentioned Newcastle there, Keith. I read a really interesting thing on an Everton supporters website around the time of the Saudi takeover of Newcastle, saying that Everton fans simply wouldn't accept that sort of deal. They would protest. Do you think that's right? Do you think there are fans of other Premier League clubs that would have turned around and said, we don't want the Saudis taking over?
That's a tricky one. I hadn't thought about that myself. I think football fans just tend to really want to see the team succeed. And having Man City and Chelsea sort of set the precedent, I think if they'd been the first club to have done it with Saudi, it might have been more of an issue. But now we're seeing that you've got to have these sort of sums to compete. I think fans can sort of understand that it may be in the best interest of the club, although there is no doubt there would be strong political sentiment in Everton. And as you know, as I've seen at Newcastle, I mean, we all talk about sports washing, but in many ways, this has kept the whole Khashoggi thing in the spotlight. Yeah. And so, you know, it hasn't necessarily made it go away, very far from it in many cases. So I think there would have been certain protests that would have carried on, but I think overall it probably would have gone through at Everton.
So as you say, you resigned from Everton, you had a break from football. Before we talk about you being lured back to Villa, what did you do during that break from football?
I was mainly working with different football federations around the world. I did a lot of work in the Middle East and helping them reorganise their football structures. Did work in India and Canada and some work back in Australia. So it was mainly helping either federations or clubs and trying to, you know, help them reorganise themselves. And so it gave me a chance to get out of the day-to-day focus and of, you know, being the go-to guy during the, you know, the media and the local media, and get a chance to really do some more thinking about football and enjoyed some travels.
In India must have been a fascinating experience, because you've got, I imagine, a tricky one as well, because you've got a huge country, but with what seems like very little interest in football.
Well, it is strange. There are basically two FAs in India, right, and the country is split west and east as to the governance of the game. And the rivalries on the east coast are absolutely phenomenal. They're still getting crowds of 100,000 in some games.
Oh, well, really? Okay.
Yeah. And then on the west coast, where I was based, around Mumbai and Pune, it isn't quite so strong in terms of the following, but still it's growing massively. But it's an absolutely fascinating environment. And to find some way to link football and cricket together was what we were trying to do in terms of facilities and training facilities, etc. And also to find ways in India to grow the base of the people that you need to effectively administer football. So you needed all the groundsmen, the ticket office managers, you needed the sports media journalists, you needed the sports physios. And we had to try and create, you know, education networks to develop all those things to let the game flourish. And so that was an interesting challenge.
I bet. So how do you go about linking football to cricket? Is it as simple as getting cricket clubs to open football teams as well?
Well, there was partly the ownership issue, but it was more about, and the one challenge that India has got is stadia, and it was about linking stadia that could be dual use in some way, and that was the main challenge we tried to work on in Mumbai and down in Pune, was working on those areas to try and create a showcase project that could be a dual purpose, and if we could, you know, make that coincide with joint ownership, that would have been the model to go forward.
So you were lured back to English football as CEO at Aston Villa in 2016, I believe, by the new owner, Tony Shearer. It turned out to be quite a volatile time. So before we talk about that, let me ask you a neutral question first. You worked at Everton, you worked at Villa, huge clubs with a massive history and tradition. How do you manage the expectations of fans at those clubs? I mean, especially at somewhere like Villa, where the first thing you notice when you're in the ground is the, you know, the commentary of the European Cup winning goal running around the four stands. It's huge expectations. So how do you manage that?
Well, actually, it was the same at Aberdeen. I mean, you know, you look back at Aberdeen, with Fergie, there was the same thing, and that was a one-town club. I think you manage the expectations. I mean, luckily, I know football inside out. I've always been a fan from that point of view. So if you understand the history, you understand the clubs, and you get to know the personality of the club before you're there, that helps you position yourself correctly. And I think it's really just being available and communicating with the fans as best you can, and letting them know that you understand them and that you understand the club and the history, and just be seen as being that sort of person who's genuinely, you know, in touch with what the club stands for.
Yeah. This is the bit that Villa fans will be waiting for. Your time at Villa with Tony Shearer was described by the Birmingham Mail as two of the unhappiest years the club has ever endured. But, spoiler alert, you ended up being completely vindicated later on. What was so poisonous about your relationship with the new owner there? What went wrong? Because obviously you would have gone in there with high hopes, great optimism. You were about to get promoted out of the Championship back into the Premier League, and it seemed like all was looking rosy for Villa. But then clearly even outsiders recognised there was something not quite right going on.
Well, you're not quite right there, Kevin, with your timing, because actually when I took over, we'd just been relegated.
Oh, it's my mistake. Okay. You came back 2 years later. Yes.
Yes. It was the second season I was there that we actually got into the playoff final. So coming in on the back of a relegation was really difficult. I mean, the whole staff were absolutely destroyed. They'd been kicked from pillar to post. The squad was going to have to be completely sorted out. I got in there with 6 weeks to go before the season started, and I had to hire a director of football at the same time as trying to do all the director of football job myself. And I think we had 12 in and 12 out in that period of time in the 6 weeks. And I think they always say that if you, for every one deal that happens, you're probably working on five, which is probably a good rule of thumb. So you can imagine there's like about 125 deals we're working on for that period of time. So it was a crazy period. But and then we uncovered all sorts of issues behind the scenes at Villa. And what I'd realised I'd taken over was more like a catering company that happened to be playing football. and it was strange the way it was unbalanced. And I tried to bring it back to being focused on being a football club and to win football matches. And that's what we tried to do. Now, at the same time, I was having my hands tied behind my back by the owner, who thought, because he played Football Manager and because he watched games on TV in China, he thought he knew everything about football. And he hired, he interviewed two managers and appointed one straight away after one interview, Roberto Di Matteo.
Yeah.
And we didn't have the best start to that first season, I think. And after 12 games, Roberto had to go. So the problem, though, was mainly that, again, I'll give you an idea of the philosophy of Tony Jarre, who he believed that footballers should be like artificial intelligence machines that should know that whatever opposition was coming at them, they should know that there's 100 moves that they should be able to program in their mind as to how to counteract and then move forward. And I said, well, that's okay, Tony. I said, you know, look, you're going to have 100 different things the footballer's got to remember. I said, that's fine. I said, but Jack Grealish can't even remember his own name. So, yeah, I don't know how you're going to get on with that. But he had a lack of appreciation of these sort of things, but was insistent on things being done in a certain way. But he started to realise as the first 12 games went on that perhaps he didn't know as much as he did. And then he left us to get on with the new change in manager when Steve Bruce came in. And we eventually, as I say, got to the playoff final the next season. So that was a relatively quick turnaround.
As you say, Keith, you know football inside out, and he clearly didn't. But did he buy the club with good intent, do you think? Or was he just so out of his depth financially and in terms of knowledge of football that things went wrong for him?
Well, what's come out of this is, this all comes back to a degree, and I did a lecture the other day on the owners and directors test as well. This is something that's pretty pretty important. It turns out now, after the event, that we found out it wasn't his money. And he was representing a syndicate in China that were investing in the club. Now, he's now in jail and probably deserves to be there, and I hope he's in there for a long time. But we couldn't check him out, and neither could the Football League, because the veil of opaque things in China, it's so very hard to penetrate that veil.
Yeah.
He might have had best intentions himself, but he wasn't truthful and honest in the way he bought it. And the whole issues that we had in the end were because he ran out of money. And from the February, we didn't get one penny from him until the May of the playoff final. And so that was always going to put us into a very difficult position.
You know, I know that you and I have a similar age, Keith, but if I didn't know that, I would have known by your ringtone that you and I are of certain age when your phone went off. So what were the circumstances of you leaving Villa then? And also tell us, I said you were completely vindicated. That vindication happened a couple of years after you left the club, didn't it?
Yeah, unfortunately, I had to sue for unfair dismissal, etc., constructive dismissal. And the case took about 18 months to 2 years to come to the actual trial, and it was all settled the day before the trial. To me, the facts were very clear. And what had happened was there was also another shady character from the dark side of football, a guy called Chris Samuelson, who has been the subject of a major football documentary by Al Jazeera called The Men Who Bought Football.
Yeah.
And he was involved, who brought Xia to the club and was also involved in having me suspended at the time when all the problems were going on. I was trying to do things by the book and preserve Villa, obviously, as best I could, but they had their own ideas and their own agenda as to what they were going to try and exact from Villa.
Do you think the Premier League's owners and directors' rules go far enough now?
I don't. I mean, look, they go, what they do go for is, you know, have you got criminality and all the rest of it? That's fine. But I do think there's got to be some form of either a bond for financial performance, particularly in the case of a Chinese owner. And I'm not saying all Chinese owners are bad, because there are good owners and bad owners. I don't think it is necessarily the nationality. But if you are a good owner and you have got the correct resources, then there should be some form of bonding to underwrite expenditure. So I think that's one area that would have to be looked at.
I'm aware, Keith, we do have some time issues. There's a couple of questions I'm keen to ask you. The first one's a pretty open one. But with your inside knowledge of football currently, what are the biggest problems you think facing English football? What changes would you make?
The biggest problem, I think, is the FA and the actual running of that side of the game. I don't think the FA is fit for purpose. I think they have really got to improve the areas of regulation in terms of the refereeing, in terms of the actual regulation of the game on that side of the FA. I think the Premier League's doing a reasonable job, and I think we've got to look at that. Now, one area that I've advocated and been very keen on is, in the same way the Premier League broke away back in the 90s, I think now is the time for a Premier League 2 and to take a number of clubs from the Championship. Yeah. And possibly have 18 clubs in each of those two divisions and start to have a Premier League 2, which I think there is an appetite for a Premier League 2 in terms of the media rights. It would help the distribution between both those 36 clubs considerably. It would allow to ease some pressure on the number of games being played as well. So I think that's one area that has to be a complete rethink in terms of the actual structure.
I'm glad you said that. I've been predicting for quite some time, certainly since the last time Palace got relegated, that a Premier League 2 would be inevitable simply because of the problems financially being caused by the relegated clubs struggling to get back in. And on that note, and I know Kieran would be cross if I didn't ask you about this, what are your views on parachute payments?
Well, this is what I'm saying Premier League 2 is, because I think parachute payments are fundamentally wrong. Right. They skew the whole Championship. They encourage more spending, and they don't really do what they're supposed to do. Whereas a Premier League 2, well, it wouldn't, make those two divisions, obviously, you know, on a level playing field. It would certainly mean that the gap wouldn't be so big. And also there'd be 18 clubs in that Premier League 2 that would be able to share in the increased media rights. And as we see more movement towards the streaming of games and those sort of companies are coming into football more for the streaming rights, I do think the media values would be there to give us a very good share. And I also think there'd be a very good payment down the pyramid from there into what would then become League One, Two. And I think the National League is now strong enough to step up to be the third league. So I think that sort of restructure is timely now, and I think it has to be looked at.
You clearly have strong views on football, Keith, and it's difficult to get those views across when you're not in the game. But will you come back to the game? Have you had enough of it?
No, I love it, and still a lot of great friends and contacts within the game. I'm involved now in a number of potential buy-sell situations with clubs. And again, now, of course, with my experience, I'd be sure it's the right owner before I came back in. But given that, and if you're involved at the start of the process, then you can satisfy yourself you're dealing with the right people. I would love to get back in at the right time.
Well, let's hope you do. And when you do, Keith, we'll talk to you again from a position as an insider. And it sounds like the game needs people like you who at least think outside the box. It's been a pleasure talking to you, Keith. Thank you very much.
Great. Thanks, Kevin. Thanks very much. Cheers.
That was fascinating, Kieran. I think we will have to get Keith back on the show because I get the sense that he has a lot more to say about certain things. There's two things that I really picked up on. First, we said the FA are not fit for purpose. But secondly, the fact that when he was at Villa, not only did it turn out, as he mentioned in that documentary, not only did it turn out that Shiar wasn't the proper owner of the club, he was the front man for a syndicate, but also it turned out there was somebody else pulling the strings. And that's astonishing that the CEO didn't discover that until afterwards.
Well, I think that is indicative of the murky world of football. And I was involved in that Al Jazeera documentary as well. And the person to whom Keith referred was, should we say, the star of the show.
But not
in an Oscar-winning way.
Yeah, and you agree with Keith, the idea of a large financial bond being paid before somebody takes over a club? Do you think that's the right way to go?
Yeah, this is one of the things I think we've suggested on a few occasions. I mean, the only reservation I have with regards to that, and I think it acts as a really good method of preventing the tire kickers coming in who think they can buy the club for nothing, sell it a few months later, and make a profit. So it's good in that regard. On the other hand, what do you do in situations as you had at Palace where, you know, had it not been for Steve Parish coming in, the club might not be in existence, and there were similar issues at Brighton and Bolton and other clubs where there is a genuine need for somebody to rescue, and perhaps you don't look too closely. Certainly that was the case at Bolton, at Wigan as well. Because you've got the next week's payroll to pay, and there's nobody else to step forward to get involved in it. So it's a really delicate one. I mean, I think Keith's right. If we have perhaps some sort of deposit, and that goes into a fund which can be used for clubs in distress, that could work in its favour.
Thank you for listening, as ever. If you'd like to make a small contribution to Always Free to Air podcasts, then please do so at patreon.com/priceoffootball. And if you have a question for our questions pod on Monday, then just email it to questions@priceoffootball.com. And in the meantime, I shall hand you over to Mr. Kieran Maguire for his customary farewell.
Well, as always, folks, thanks very much for the support for the show. We do appreciate it in all the ways that you send us love and cash from Patreon, which is almost as important. If you want to support the show in any way, the Price of Football Live, we have now sold out. There might be a few returned. We might be able to get another table for another 10 or so seats, but we're not quite sure as yet. But we do appreciate that. We're slightly befuddled as to why you're coming along, but we'll do our damnedest to make sure that you go away with a smile on your face. If you want to support the show in any other way, you can do so by going on to your podcast app on your smartphone and giving us a review. And you if you give us 5 stars, we'd be very, 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 very honoured, very, very chuffed. It doesn't matter what you say on the review. You could say you would rather have it hosted by Linda Lusardi and Beaker from the Muppets. And it wouldn't make a blind bit of difference, apparently, to the algorithms of Apple and Co. It still helps us in the charts, and it helps us to have credibility when we're trying to book guests.
Do you know what? I've worked with both of those.
Have you?
Both delightful. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
The price of football. The price of football.